is Jemima Greco from Newcastle University. And unless she's changed her title, which is always possible, I can now read it. Disobedient Objects and the Commodification of Feminist Process. Jemima.
Thank you. And let me start as well by thanking Maria and Ella so much for putting this fantastic conference together. I already said this is turning out to be my favorite conference of the year already. So many, like, my mind is like exploding with ideas and all kinds of things. So thank you for bringing us all together. I'm interested in the mass popularization of different feminist products that sort of started to happen in the last 2 years, really kind of especially from the Women's March onwards. I want to argue that this trend isn't, it includes the sort of selling, using feminist ideas to sell products, yes. So in that kind of co-optation going on, but as it's sort of done in the past, you know, like selling skincare products and cosmetics under kind of ideas of empowerment and so on. But I would say it matters that the F word, feminism, is being used now. And it's that its concepts and its history and its images and objects are being redeployed in this marketplace. Because it has an effect on the operational mode of feminist politics. So what is seen to count and constitute as feminist politics is being changing, it's transforming. And so in my research project, I'm trying to focus on objects as a way of examining these dynamics and these sort of changes happening between feminist street protest and the commodification of its, in a way, its material strategies. And I take the sort of the concept of obedient and disobedient objects from an exhibition that was at the Victoria and Albert Museum in 2014-2015. And it was an exhibition that showed a lot of it was centered around objects that had been used in a disobedient way. So protest objects, barricades, Molotov cocktail, and all kinds of DIY things that activists and protesters have used throughout kind of history. And trying to chart the sort of untold story of these objects. And the curators, Catherine Flood and Gavin Grinden, were interested in the role that the objects played in social change alongside other forms of visual and musical and artistic expression. And they wanted to shed light on the material micropolitics of activism. And a story that's often told in the histories of material culture. So you don't often see these kinds of things in museums and galleries and stuff because, you know, these objects are often lost or destroyed or appropriated for other use after they've been involved in the sort of political use, and they become only kind of documented often by accident in like film or photographs and pictures and stuff. So kind of it was interesting how to read about the exhibition and how, you know, getting these objects was also challenging. But anyway, they introduced this concept of disobedient objects. They don't, you know, go in a lot of detail what they mean by it, but they call it an evocative proposition or an invitation rather than a typology or a closed concept. And their interest lies in the questions opened at the limits of object-based tactics and strategies that movements adopt to succeed. And there was like a sort of email roundtable with a lot of scholars talking about this, and one sociologist, John Holloway, said, "Disobedient objects speak of pain and fury and dignity. They scream their no at us. At the same time, they express hope." So maybe a yes to change and meaningful life, as do the political acts for which they were purposed. So, but then we think about what are obedient objects thing? I think this is much more difficult to say what this is. I mean, we'd say yes, okay, obedient objects are probably the opposite of disobedient objects. We can think of instruments of torture, canes, prison keys, managerial software programs in universities, for instance, or mundane objects like wallets, traffic lights, or elevator music, or telephone line hold music. Things that sort of make us obey and be passive or get us to bend to the will, you know, in a Foucauldian disciplinary kind of way. So So, and I think there are some objects that are probably, but can be both disobedient and obedient, depending on context. So, you know, is what makes an object disobedient or obedient? I think it depends. But I think Flood and Grindon are right not to pin this down too tightly so that it can remain useful and provocative, because I think that's what it's kind of, if what it's useful for is to provoke more questions. But I think there's things that we can say, though. So obedient objects discipline, they rather than disobey. They depoliticize rather than politicize. And especially in our sort of advanced capitalist stage, disobedient objects have use value. So they're useful rather than having primarily exchange value. And I think that distinction is kind of something I need to develop more. I haven't really done more the conceptual work for it. But if we think of objects in feminist history, like the suffragette movement is often sort of hailed as an example of the first successful branding campaign, if you want to call it that. But I think, as I'll argue, I think branding has a different strategic sort of underpinning. But anyway, the suffragettes were very creative in creating all kinds of objects that were kind of disobedient. So the pin on the left was given to suffragettes who had been on hunger strike and force-fed in prison. Then there's another kind of pin just to sort of for everyday use. They took pennies and printed Votes for Women on the coin so that the, you know, it would be circulated among people within wallets, so, you know, subverting in a way the sort of use of money, even if it wasn't meant necessarily in a socialist way. They also made things like teapots and things like that. That teapot, I think, was in the exhibition. And of course, the famous sash with their, you know, the famous color scheme. So making all kinds of different products, right? And then we can think of also, I think, well, one of the things I've centered around my research a lot is the T-shirt. And, you know, that especially in the second wave, how the T-shirt was quite important in various kinds of activism, but also feminist activism. And it's the political economy behind these objects is also significant. So not only were they, these have kind of, you know, various functions like keeping up morale, awareness raising, but also like fundraising was quite a significant, you know, thing. So trying to raise funds for the actual for you know, being able to do the activism. And I think this is what's sort of, we can sort of briefly see what's changed a lot. So there are like sort of companies being set up that sell feminist products. And for instance, this feminist apparel company saying it's a T-shirt that resists the patriarchy, it empowers communities, fights for progress, it celebrates you. It's a movement. So in a way, for suffragettes and for many sort of second wave feminists, objects were a means to an end, you know, for fundraising, advocacy, morale building. But, you know, we're seeing more of like objects becoming becoming the ends in a way. The object only has to be consumed for it to count as participation. So consumption, in a way, as in consumption and shopping, participation in consumer culture for its own sake starts to become equated with participation in feminist movement. So to shop is to be a feminist. And I kind of call the concept I'm using to describe this feminist commodity activism combining so the concept of commodity activism, which is often linked to the corporate social responsibility in the literature, and feminist and commodity feminism, which has been used to describe that post-feminist selling of skincare products under feminist labels. But, you know, this is sort of described the explicit sort of feminist label of selling of products. So describe the mode where consumption becomes the primary mode of feminist political action. I'm not saying, of course, this applies to all feminist action. We're talking about a very particular kind, you know, of area of sort of this strange feminist resurgence that we're seeing. So, you know, we're seeing pins, socks, T-shirts, signs, and various practices, shouting and slogans and all kinds of things, and the aesthetics of what we normally associate with feminist street protest being transformed. There's also an economic aspect. So there's this sort of corporate social responsibility, like buy a shirt and help, you know, a charity or something, women's charity. But also the businesses like the feminist apparel company says that just by buying one of their shirts, it's a for-profit company. They have some shirts that have teamed up with some organizations like Civil Liberties Union and stuff like that. to give a portion of their donors. But basically, it's a for-profit business that says that this is a feminist company and doing feminist, you know, activism. And they organized, there was street protests as well. So, or street campaigns, but I'm not going to talk about it in this talk. So this companization of feminist activists, the corporatization of a feminist, sort of alleged feminist movement, which is kind of, it's in a vague area. And then finally, this question of subjectivity. Catherine just talked very thoroughly about that, so I won't go into it. But what I focus on this is sort of how the object becomes also a medium for the production of feminism, the feminist subject or feminist identity, feminist self-identification as a mode of value production for women. So just to start with the aesthetic, so I mentioned like this is the sort of second wave feminism, you know, very kind of typical image that you'd associate with a protest in 1970 in Washington, D.C., not having feminist shirts on, but anyway, this kind of aesthetic, of course, is not just, you know, exclusive to feminism. There are many other social movements at the time, including especially civil rights, that feminists were very inspired by, and the, of course, 19 sort of late 60s student protests and Vietnam movement and everything. So, but feminism, I think, feminists did leave their own mark on that with their slogans and sort of thinking that it was can integrate into that and adopted those strategies. And so Sarah already showed one of these slides from sort of the last few years, of course. So the one on the left is the same Chanel show in 2014, where a fake feminist rally was staged in the catwalk of the Palais Royal in Paris, and so the models marched down the catwalk carrying these sort of Chanel embossed megaphones, shouting feminist slogans, and waving their fists in the air, and holding various feminist-themed signs. Some were more feminist than others, so like there was "Women's rights are all right," "He for she," "Ladies first." Then also "Be your own stylist," "Tweet is better than tweet," but you can find the video on YouTube to see how it plays out. And then the second one was right after, like 2 weeks after the Women's March, the New York Fashion Week that week, that year was incredibly sort of feministy themed. There was like Planned Parenthood pins going around and everything. But this too was sort of a fake protest outside a show, outside the show venue where the models wearing, you know, all the clothes were holding these sort of girl power and reproductive rights signs. And it's interesting that this looks and sounds like feminist activism. You know, it replicates the performativity of feminist protest, but it's entirely staged. You know, so it, of course, doesn't have the long-term bottom-up commitments to community solidarity and collective action. And the feminists, so feminists become kind of subjectivized as consumers or even advertising billboards, blurring the boundary between fashion industry and protest, consumption and activism. And especially then when you have these t-shirts that are being sold as, you know, like you're participating in, you know, funding women's shelters or something by buying this t-shirt. You know, that's where especially we see this blurring of like this the fashion industry and activism. And of course, it also deflects criticism, you know, potential feminist criticism of the fashion industry. For instance, you know, its beauty norms and racism and health and things like that that you could associate. So there's another sort of object, sort of material side, or a material side that I want to focus on, the object, the mode of production. In particular, this picture is of the Sea Red Women's Workshop, which was a printing collective in the 1970s and 80s. But before I go to that, so look at some historical examples from the suffrage movement. Again, has actually been just a really interesting context to think about what feminist activism has done. So posters have been sort of long-standing way of articulating social critique and commentary, as well as making political demands. The visual language of the suffragette posters, as well as others, of course, has been designed to shock, to mobilize and provoke. And so some the art historians claim that these posters display, quote, none of the soothing or graceful qualities that characterized traditional representation of femininity at the time, end quote. Many were intentionally crude and offensive. And as disobedient objects, feminist posters were tools in a brutal battle. Posters almost invariably were produced by female artists, both as groups and individuals that wanted to contribute to the movement with their skills, thus also playing an important role in the development of 20th century women's graphic expression. One such group was the Artists' Suffrage League, a group of female graphic artists and illustrators founded in 1907 to help NUSWSS, so the National Union of Women's Suffrage Society's Mud March. And they designed and produced posters, postcards, leaflets, and teacups and banners to sort of visually strengthen their campaign. And another group was the Suffrage Atelier, a non-professional artist society that produced hand-printed graphic material for the Women's Freedom League. And the Atelier also set up an educational space for women artists to learn a variety of artistic techniques and methods. So they were volunteers, and they're also producing these themselves and also trying to educate other women to produce graphic material. So there's a kind of horizontal kind of mode of organizing. Same in the sort of 70s and 80s. This is probably one of the most well-known kind of graphic projects in the feminism at the time. See Red was inspired by other nonprofit, volunteer-based political art collectives in the late 60s and 70s, including other feminist ones. And they're committed to challenging the dominant ideological model of the creative process that they associated with the commercialization of artwork and mystification of the artist, and what they saw as the silently abusive aspects of top-down chains of management. To resist these practices, CRAD was dedicated to socialist feminist critique of the art world, and they promoted the equal shared ownership of the workplace and the production. And so they rejected the individual ownership and production of the artwork. One would start a project and then it would get passed around. So in the end, like, the authorship would disappear, and none of them are signed by individual artists. They all kind of are collectively present as collectively produced. And they wanted to reject this kind of a patriarchal cult of the artist mentality that they learned in art school, where the artist is seen as this uniquely creative individual, and that nourished secretive and proprietary work patterns through this sort of individualistic and self-engrossed idea of an artist. And so they sort of really eschewed market relations and rejected competition, individualism, and ownership, and remained committed to this communal art project, one that they admitted was a challenge, but one that they actually overcame, and the workshop was around for about 10, 15 years. But if we contrast this to posters that are being kind of produced in some contexts at the moment, most people might know the LUK 2013 Rebranding Feminism issue, and then they have these feminist issues for the next 3 or 4 years. And in the very first one, they basically set up, they asked three feminist activists and to pair up with three high-flying advertising agencies to produce three feminist campaigns that had to have a manifesto, a hashtag, and a poster. So here you have the posters and their hashtags and who was involved. And of course, like, compared to, that's why I don't bring up the historical examples as to romanticize them necessarily, even though I think they have a lot of things that could still be incredibly useful, but rather to show the contrast in, like, what is going on in the creative process of producing the sort of artifacts of protest. And if you can call this protest, maybe. The model was replicating the model of an advertising agency. So, Elle approached the agencies to do them, and then they had expert advisors, so these feminist activists, to produce content to sell their product, the magazine. Of course, then Elle had veto power over various ideas. So over the course of doing this, they vetoed things that had any kind of anti-consumerist content, or if they deemed something was too unfeminine or too judgmental, than like too judgmental of other women, because that was one of the messages that, oh, is feminism too angry and too judgmental? No, it's happy and fun and things like this. So, you know, none of that stuff. So one was like this, that one team tried to critique like hair removal and like Brazilian waxes, and they said no to that, for instance. So, you know, this is kind of where how you get the confront, okay, how really, if that is something that they'll reject, what, you know, what, you can't really get much further from that. Anyway, politically. So, yeah. And so you could say that, like, in a way, okay, maybe it's expecting too much to ask something like L to produce something radical, in the sense that, you know, are they structurally incapable of of producing something that would question their own, the conditions of their own means of production, in a way. It's because you know, consumerism is their bread and butter, literally. So, but, you know, one of the consequences is, of course, dumbing down the feminist content, because you need to sell to a mass audience. So they in fact saw their task as to simplify rather than complicate the world. So the commissioning editor of Elle said in an interview that during the production process that, quote, feminism can be a heavy word that is burdened with a lot of history and a lot of complicated ideas, but it's kind of our job to take those complications away and make it something that people will want to embrace, end quote. So, you know, yeah. And I mean, I won't go into, you know, so I've also analyzed these posters, and, you know, obviously I think, you know, like previous presenters have said a lot, and we can already, you know, deconstruct what's going on here, the individualization of, like, for instance, you know, labor, what feminist questions about labor and things like that that go on here, and the, you know, lack of structural solutions to by individualizing problems, as women's individual problems, so. And I do want to, I did remove this one. Maybe I can make this visible again. Oh, hang on. So, because, because there's been sort of, I think there is often this implication that neoliberal feminism equals white feminism, and that, you know, there was this talk about that it kind of glosses over differences. I mean, there's something like a bit more nuanced that we need to tease out, because so this is a feminist apparel company, and they have this feminist activist box that you can order. It costs £60 or something. But, you know, this is intersectional feminism being appropriated, right? It's not just white feminism. Here it's like, if it is intersectional, is it feminism? Angela Davis's book. Then there's two like protest pamphlets that you'd normally get at a protest, and like, you know your rights and you police community. There's the stickers and the riot shirts. Bag, your tote bag, or your little chemist bag. So, you know, like what Sarah was saying, like in her talk too, that there's like this diversity is a resource as well, and it's not immune from this, commodification. And there's a whole like new stuff being produced around like, you know, this wokeness and things like that. Like it's also becoming very quickly, you know, it's only just kind of come up into the sort of popular consciousness, and immediately it's being commodified. But so as Elle and other fashion brands try to make feminism marketable, feminism also becomes forged into what Sarah Ahmed calls a happy object, something that good feelings are directed toward. It's assumed that happiness follows if only you can possess that object. So traditionally, these have been things like marriage or children or beauty. And feminism, Ahmed argues, is antithetical to happy objects, because feminism disturbs the fantasy that happiness can be found in particular places. And yet, this is including maybe feminism itself, right? Like, so in branding, by instilling positive perceptions to produce value, this requires producing visions and promises of happiness, attractiveness, desirability, and success with broad appeal. So also, as mentioned earlier, like this idea of pleasure, you know, it's promising so much pleasure, and that's why it's attractive. You know, maybe it's sort of the Foucauldian thing, you know, like we submit because it's so attractive. The process of branding feminism into happy objects reshapes feminism into a glamorous self-representation that once embraced and adopted by the self should deliver and increase the value of the personal brand and social capital, as Catherine said. The feminist identity is offered to women as a prepackaged product, abstract enough to accommodate diverse selves. So, you know, it's abstract. I think that neoliberal feminism, even though I think we're only starting to see it, it is abstract enough to accommodate all of these diverse feminisms and that we, you know, have been emerging or have been existing for a longer time. But, you know, so it's diverse enough, it's abstract enough to accommodate diversity by letting a variety of women see themselves in it, while nonetheless at the same time eclipsing them. So in the process, and so here, like, you know, I put these shirts here, these pictures here, because precisely the sort of self-labeling, you know, that's going on here. I don't know why Santa is a feminist, though. But, yeah. So in the process, women are asked to accommodate the world rather than challenge it. The attempt of companies to extract surplus value from the history and tools of feminist activism is dangerous for feminism. It has the potential to transform the logic of feminist action to one where its political imagination is limited to the ontology of the market and one's relation to oneself rather than others. And as a sort of final picture of this, sort of how the object in a way helps us think about the changing of the self. So this is the picture on the left. Is Alex a photo of Alex Dobkin, a feminist who was in a sort of worked in a bookstore in New York in the 1970s, and they produced this T-shirt. So it was like a lesbian anti-racist collective, and they produced this T-shirt to raise funds for the bookshop, and they organized. It was a center for organizing and publication and meetings and all kinds of stuff like that. But it's been now reproduced by various companies. Nike has one with Cara Delevingne and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, like, I think this kind of captures the difference, right? Now it's the feminist looking at herself in the mirror rather than the feminist looking out into the world, you know, with maybe some kind of different kinds of aspirations. Like, is the feminist, you know, the feminist becomes the subject who gazes well at herself, also mediated through technologies of social media, etc. Okay, thank you.